Vladimir Putin is a wanted man. There's an international warrant out for his arrest. But South Africa has invited him to visit, and a debate has erupted there about what to do.
The easiest equation here is to withdraw the invitation. He doesn't come, and then we don't have this problem.
I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show, in Ukraine, it's a busy time for tattoo artists. In wartime, body art equals patriotism.
People want to make Ukrainian symbols to improve their feelings and show their Ukrainian culture.
Plus, Nigeria's brain drain. Doctors say they can't make a living, so they leave the country.
There's nobody I know that has come back. But I know that people are willing to come back if there is improvement in pay.
Nigeria's government answers, don't let young doctors leave in the first place. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us. We begin today in Sudan, where the prospects for peace are looking dimmer. The National Army in Sudan has stepped back from talks with a rival paramilitary force. Up until this news, ceasefire agreements were not being observed. Since the fighting began 6 weeks ago, hundreds of people have been killed. More than 1 million people are now displaced, according to the United Nations. Many have gotten out of Sudan, but countless others are stuck in limbo. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi has more on that.
Salim Simon Cody Kanidi was working as an English teacher in Khartoum when the fighting broke out in April.
The situation there is really very bad. People are dying. You can find bodies of people in streets, under the bridge.
He talked with his family about fleeing, but they didn't want to.
Unfortunately, they refused. They don't want to travel. They don't want to leave the home because they say, that how can we leave our things?
So he made the difficult decision to leave Khartoum on his own. After more than 20 hours of traveling by bus, he reached Port Sudan, a city in the east. That's where he is now. Kanidi tells me people there are struggling.
It is very crowded by many people. No food, no water. That means they're going to die soon. Or if they are sick, they are not going to have enough money to go to the hospital. So I'm surviving now here in Port Sudan. I don't know how my life here is going to look like.
Kanidi tells me he has been staying with a relative, but it's crowded there too. He knows his family can't afford to support everyone, so he is thinking about his next steps.
So my next plan is to go to a neighboring country, or if I find a chance to US, it will be great and it will be something fantastic. But unfortunately, I think this is going to be like impossible.
Traveling requires money, he says, which he doesn't have. Hundreds of thousands of people have been able to flee Sudan to neighboring countries and further abroad. But many people are still stuck in limbo, like Mohamed al-Mubarak Beda. The last time I spoke with him, he was fleeing Khartoum on a bus with his family. He tells me they successfully reached Argin. That's right on Sudan's border with Egypt. His female relatives were allowed in, but he and his male cousin were not.
After dropping off our family at the gates of the Egyptian border, Argin, and the Egyptians refusing to give me and my cousin visas, even though we were with our family, we had to figure out a way of getting to Halfa so we could get to the consulate.
The Egyptian consulate in Wadi Halfa, he means, so they could formally apply for a visa. To get there, they got a ride on a boat across Lake Nubia. When they arrived, the scene was pretty chaotic.
We found massive numbers of men, some women, some children trying to leave the country and applying for visas.
Kubeda spent the first few days sleeping in a mosque until students at a local college opened up their dorms. But a month later, he is still waiting for that visa to enter Egypt. He tells me there are major bureaucratic delays. He says he's happy his family is safe now in Cairo, but he wonders if and when he will be able to reunite with them. For others in Sudan, leaving the country simply isn't an option. So many people have settled in other parts of the country, like Sanahit Hussein Ahmed Bashir. She escaped the fighting in Khartoum about a month ago. She says she and her family fled because she was pregnant and the hospitals were closed. They arrived at a camp for displaced people more than 100 miles away from Khartoum. People here are full of hospitality, she says, and they don't treat us as foreigners. Ahmed recently gave birth at the camp, and the small community of displaced people took time to celebrate. Bashir says if the situation in Khartoum calms down, they will return. If not, they will stay put, where it's safe. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
In Brazil, the lower house of Congress approved a controversial bill last night that many say will gut indigenous land rights. The bill now moves on to the Senate. Indigenous people in Brazil are concerned that if it's approved, it could roll back a lot of gains made over the past 35 years. Reporter Michael Fox has that story.
Yesterday began like this in Brazil. Indigenous peoples blocked major highways in several spots around the country. In Sao Paulo, they sang and chanted. They set fire to debris on the highway to stop cars from passing. Their demand, no to Bill 490. Local indigenous leader Arapoto spoke to a Brazilian news outlet.
A gente não é agressivo, a gente não é violento, a gente só quer ser ouvida.
We are not aggressive or violent. We just want to be heard. Because this Bill 490 is a law that will kill us. It will exterminate us, she said.
Vou encerrar a votação.
Last night, it passed anyway.
Sim.
Conservative congressmen tied to the country's big ag caucus applauded. Originally drafted 16 years ago, PL 490 questions indigenous people's right to their land. It's based on a theory called marco temporal, or the time frame. In essence, it states that only those indigenous peoples recognized as being on their land on the day of the passage of Brazil's constitution in 1988 can have the legal right to their territory today. The expectation is that this could lead to a cascade of lawsuits questioning native peoples' rights to their land, even those territories already well-established or demarcated. Indigenous Peoples Minister Sonia Wajajara asked Brazilians to reject the vote yesterday over Instagram.
A votação em plenário para decidir, né, sobre a vida dos povos indígenas.
This is going to decide the life of indigenous people, she said. It blocks any type of process of demarcation of indigenous land. Anthropologist Antenor Vaz worked with isolated peoples for many years at Brazil's indigenous agency.
Todos os indígenas serão atingidos.
He says all indigenous peoples will be impacted by this bill, but isolated and recently contacted peoples will be impacted drastically because it's almost impossible to prove that they were on their land on October 5th, 1988. No one likes to talk about genocide here, said indigenous leader Celia Xicriaba before the vote. But that's what it is, using the structure of the government, the structure of the state with a pen to assassinate indigenous peoples. Tied to this legislation are also more than a dozen other bills which could open indigenous territories to mining and resource extraction from outside entities. The vote, which was fast-tracked last week, caught many people by surprise. Clayson Juruna is the young chief of the Juruna people in the Amazonian state of Pará.
Eu pensei que não voltasse agora essa conversa, eu pensei que nem ia voltar mais essa conversa depois da gestão que assumiu o Brasil, depois do presidente atual.
I didn't think that this would even come up now under Lula, he says, because Lula's discourse before he was elected was that he was an environmentalist and in favor of indigenous peoples. But today, we don't even know what to expect, he says. Since his election, Lula has advanced indigenous rights, pushing back on illegal miners and recognizing six new indigenous territories last month. All congressional members of Lula's Workers' Party voted against the bill yesterday. But the country's big ag caucus wields tremendous power, and it has long been looking to open up indigenous land for development. The group's allies say indigenous peoples have acquired too much land. Rodolfo Nogueira is an ally of former President Jair Bolsonaro, who voted for the bill.
PL, tão importante, projeto tão importante que vai trazer a pacificação no campo.
This bill is so important, and without a doubt, it will contribute to food security for the whole world, he said. Analysts say Congress's rush to approve the bill this week is because the Supreme Court is set to finally decide over the constitutionality of marco temporal, the theory that only indigenous territory from 1988 can be recognized. Indigenous peoples have promised to continue to fight to defend their land and their rights. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
These days, Vladimir Putin can't travel freely like most heads of state. That's because there's an international arrest warrant hanging over him. Last March, the International Criminal Court in The Hague issued the arrest warrant for war crimes in Ukraine. But now some South African officials are trying to clear the way for Putin to visit their country. They've invited him to attend a gathering of the BRICS in August, BRICS being the acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Glynis Breytenbach is going to court to try and block South Africa's offer of diplomatic immunity. She's an opposition member of parliament in South Africa and a former state prosecutor. She joins us from Cape Town. Your party, the Democratic Alliance, filed papers in the High Court in Pretoria this week seeking a declaratory order. What is that order all about? What are you trying to force?
Well, basically, it's a preemptive step to try and force the South African government to comply with its obligations both internationally and domestically. South Africa is a founding signatory of the Rome Statute, establishing the International Criminal Court. When Omar al-Bashir visited here 2 or 3 years ago, he also had a warrant of arrest out for him from the ICC, and our government failed to arrest him, detain him, and deliver him to the ICC. We litigated that issue as well. The court order came hours after he had fled the country with the assistance of, we suspect, the government in the night. And we want to prevent that happening again.
Right. Some members of parliament are essentially seeking a waiver to allow people like Putin, wanted by the ICC, to come to the country. Now, you mentioned the 2015 case of former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir visiting South Africa. Didn't that visit essentially set a legal precedent? I mean, he was wanted by the ICC for war crimes. There was an arrest warrant. South Africa did not arrest him.
It did not set a precedent simply because in so doing, the South African government essentially broke the law. They ignored both South African domestic law, and the court in essence found that there was an obligation to arrest al-Bashir and detain him and deliver him. Our court is bound by that precedent that they have to, in fact, comply with their obligations. But, you know, we worry that they may not because they've already articulated that they're not particularly keen to do it and that they're looking for ways to get around it.
Glynis Breytenbach, aside from you, who are the voices calling for South Africa to withdraw the invitation to President Putin, and who are those supporting this proposed visit?
Most of the South African opposition parties don't support Putin's visit. We're concerned that his visit is going to cause unnecessary turmoil. There is this obligation to arrest him. So the easiest equation here is to withdraw the invitation. He doesn't come and then we don't have this problem. But also, there are different opinions. You know, some South Africans feel that the ICC hasn't been entirely fair or unbiased in the way it conducts its business. But that's something that can be addressed, you know, from within the ICC. But I think the largest portion of the South African citizens would rather avoid this turmoil.
Help us understand what is behind the support in South Africa for Vladimir Putin, those who do support him in this visit.
Well, South Africa has a history of Russian support prior to 1994, which has engendered some loyalty amongst South Africans. We're all members of BRICS. But the refusal to see that type of cozy relationship with Russia hurts South Africa, hurts our international image, hurts our economy, more importantly, is a bit puzzling, and that's one that worries us a great deal. Our economy is not a robust one, and we're hardly in a position to damage it any further.
If the High Court rules in your favor and calls for Putin's arrest were he to step foot in South Africa, can the government ignore that ruling?
I suppose practically they could, but it would be exceptionally difficult for them to do, and it would not be without very, very serious repercussions, both at home and abroad. The International Criminal Court was set up for a very good reason. And so, you know, we have to keep bashing away at those prosecutions until we succeed. Giving up isn't the answer.
Glynis Breytenbach is an opposition member of parliament in South Africa. She's South Africa's shadow minister of justice. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
A royal wedding in Jordan brings together elites from across the region. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In the Middle East, they're planning for a big party. The Crown Prince of Jordan is about to tie the knot with a Saudi royal, and the Jordanian government is hyping things up.
It's
sounds of the pre-party there, a free concert with some of the biggest names in music across the Middle East. The official ceremony is tomorrow. We called up Amr El-Subaili to fill us in on the details. He teaches in the International Studies Department at the University of Jordan. He's also a columnist for the Jordan Times. Omar, tell us more about these two royals. We're talking pretty high society in the Mideast, right?
Yeah, you know, this is very exceptional because here we are dealing with the Crown Prince of Jordan, who's been like an emerging figure.
Right, and this is the son of King Abdullah, right?
You know, according to the constitution, the Crown Prince has no role, but he was entrusted recently by His Majesty having roles. He was with His Majesty in mostly all of his trips abroad. His image is becoming like a more obvious youth image of the Jordanian society, and as well on the military side. When it comes to the King of Jordan, we have usually these two sides, the military and civic, and I think his image is strongly emerging as somebody who's involved in all the details of the political scene in Jordan.
And who is the Saudi bride-to-be?
Well, for sure, before the wedding, she was unknown for Jordanians. What we know, that at the end, it's a Saudi family. It's not a political family, but it belongs to the business people in Saudi Arabia. But at the same time, it comes in a moment where Jordan really needs to improve its relation with Saudi Arabia after years of cold relations. And I guess this might represent something very, very good and positive for the Crown Prince in his way as well to achieve something for Jordan. And, you know, Saudi Arabia today, for everybody in the Middle East, we think that it is the hub of the region.
How beneficial could this marriage be for relations between Saudi Arabia and Jordan?
Let me tell you, like, we noticed that even the Crown Prince is enjoying good relation with MBS.
MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, yeah.
In various occasions, he was his guest. There was a confirmation today that he's attending as well tomorrow, the wedding, which means like something never happened before for the Saudi Crown Prince, who moves rarely out of Saudi Arabia.
Right. Well, we heard the pre-party concert a moment ago, superstars of music from across the Arab world. How extravagant are the preparations?
Well, you know, I don't think it is just a wedding party. It's also an introduction for the future King of Jordan.
Yeah, but what do Jordanians think of the wedding? I mean, the economy has been on the skids, inflation impacting life there like in many places. Is the average Jordanian in the mood for lavish festivities, regardless of what they mean?
If we consider that many people are suffering economically, they will not, of course, see this positively.
Do your students at the University of Jordan ever talk about how they feel about the royal family or these kinds of events?
You know, this is a model is different a bit. It is an absolute monarchy, and Jordan has never experienced another model, you know, since the foundation of Jordan as an emirate in 1921, and then to a monarchy in 1946. There was no other model. Is something not easy. Like, you have always to be careful of how to keep your image and how to show your people that you are there to serve them, not to make use of their fortunes.
Omar El-Subaili teaches in the International Studies Department at the University of Jordan. He also writes a column for the Jordan Times. Omar, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Marco.
I think it's safe to say we've all had trouble at some point or another getting an appointment with a doctor. In the U.S., there's just one doctor for every 300 people, so hospitals here and in the U.K. increasingly rely on physicians trained overseas from countries like Nigeria. Hundreds of doctors leave Nigeria each year to work in other countries. But as they help ease a doctor shortage in the West, they're leaving behind an even deeper shortage back home in Nigeria. Lawmakers there have proposed a bill that would compel medical school graduates to stay and work in the country for 5 years. Emeka Origi is one of the doctors opposed to the bill. He's president of the Nigerian Association of Resident Doctors. He joins us from Umuahia, capital of Abia State, Nigeria. Dr. Origi, lay out the problem for us. How overworked are doctors in Nigeria? Like, how serious is the shortage of doctors there?
Very, very overworked. And, you know, the issue of brain drain has been massive. You have hospitals depleted of doctors and nurses. You have one doctor doing the work of so many.
And doctor, what does that overwork look like for you?
There is no doctor in Nigeria working in public hospital that is not overworked. There is none. Because of the massive depletion we have, people are leaving. in some hospitals, they are closing down some departments.
So, as you know, many Nigerian doctors say that they are so badly paid that they must look for jobs overseas to support their families. How true is that?
The most important cause of this massive exodus of doctors and nurses is because of the poor remuneration we are getting.
Poor pay.
Poor pay, yeah. And it's essentially what we've been getting for over 10 years. And of course, ever since then, you know, we have had skyrocketing inflation. General cost of living has increased.
Yeah, well, inflation is real and obviously impacts doctors and their families. So, Dr. Origi, this bill before the legislature in Nigeria would force newly trained doctors and dentists to serve in Nigeria for 5 years before they are granted a full license. It sounds like a way to ease the shortage of doctors in Nigeria. But what is your organization, the Nigerian Association of Resident Doctors? What's your objection?
Okay, so we have always said that in trying to address this exodus of doctors from Nigeria, that government should not on their own go and bring up policies because they are going to make mistakes. And that was exactly what happened. That bill was poorly thought out. Most of the numbers and the figures they quoted there are wrong. And what he's predicating the bill on, that medical education is subsidized in Nigeria, to what extent? There has not been any study from them showing us to what extent they subsidize the medical education.
Let me ask you this. So, Dr. Origi, how much does the Nigerian government subsidize medical education? Like, do new doctors owe the government when they graduate?
We don't. And that is the point we are trying to make. We don't. What they simply do is to place side by side the school fees we pay here with what is paid in America or US or Europe. Okay? Secondly, you cannot also do that comparison because the salary of a Nigerian doctor is nothing compared to the salary of American graduate of medicine.
Yeah, so then you believe the government really doesn't have much influence on how to direct those medical school graduates.
They don't, because if, for instance, you have placed someone on scholarship, okay, and before you set out to do that, you have an agreement with a person that you are going to bond him or her after graduation, that would be fine. I mean, we that is even happening now. But to place a blanket ban or a blanket restriction of movement of fresh graduates of medicine, it is against the law. It is against freedom of movement. It is modern-day slavery.
Mm. Some Nigerian doctors argue that they need exposure to Western medical systems to bring that experience back to Nigeria. But how many doctors have you seen return to Nigeria once they've worked in the West?
They mostly do not return because the conditions are not better. There's nobody I know that has come back. But I know that people are willing to come back if there is improvement in pay.
Dr. Emeka Origi is president of the Nigerian Association of Resident Doctors. He was updating us on Nigeria's physician shortage and a controversial proposal to prevent Nigerian doctors from leaving the country after graduating medical school. Doctor, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're with the world. From Pac-Man to Call of Duty, cloud gaming has the potential to put video games on any device anywhere. But the future is on hold. British regulators are pumping the brakes on a major business merger.
It's very awkward that on the one hand, the UK dismisses the deal and the EU approves it. So it raises the question, well, who's right?
Plus, politics takes center court at the French Open, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. At Axiom Space Headquarters in Houston, this was the moment as a spacecraft with an all-private astronaut team splashed down in the Gulf of Mexico.
AX2 is back on Earth.
On board were four astronauts, two Americans, and two Saudis, including the first Arab woman sent into orbit. It was a second space station mission organized, equipped, and trained entirely at private expense by a Houston-based venture. And it was not the only mission to the International Space Station in recent days. That included astronauts from the Middle East. Tim Fernholz is a senior reporter at Quartz and the author of Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. Tim, what more can you tell us about the two Saudi astronauts on the spacecraft that splashed down yesterday? Who are they and why were they chosen?
Ali Al-Karni is a former fighter jet pilot, what you might say is sort of the classic model for an astronaut. And then Rayana Bernawi is the first Saudi woman and first Arab woman to go to space. She's a scientist, and it is a big moment for that country, which is putting a lot of emphasis on investment in this kind of science and technology development.
Yeah, and as I understand it, the Saudi astronaut's visit to the ISS overlapped with that of a space crew from the United Arab Emirates, making it the first time three astronauts from the Arab world were aboard the space station together. What are the interests in space of these two countries?
They are economic. Probably won't surprise your listeners to know that both of these countries have incredible wealth from oil resources, from exporting petroleum. And as the world is changing, they are aware of the decarbonization agenda around the world. They want to invest in new science and new technology that can help their economies. And if you talk to folks from, say, the Saudi Space Commission, they are saying, we want to inspire people in our countries to get invested in science and technology education. And so, like a lot of space missions, a big chunk of this is inspiration to show people across the Arab world that they are part of space exploration. There is more to be done, and to get excitement around that.
What are Saudi Arabia and the UAE actually thinking in terms of how space might help solve the carbon problem on Earth?
Well, their carbon problem is more that they envision a world where less oil is being purchased and used. So they want to have access to advanced, you know, chip making technology, sensor technology, all of those things that could give them a path towards economic development where they're not as reliant on the West for those kinds of technologies.
There are other Middle Eastern countries also active in space. Which countries are we talking about and what are they doing?
So Saudi Arabia, obviously a leader, and the United Arab Emirates, which has launched a successful Mars mission and has just announced that they're going to send a space probe to the asteroid belt. Kuwait and Bahrain have been building satellites and launching them. In Oman, they're planning to build a spaceport because it's sort of well located to launch rockets over the ocean. And even Egypt's Nilesat satellite TV company is successful. So all of these countries are participating, and it generally just depends on how much money they have. Because one issue here is all of these countries are essentially buying hardware or space services from either the US, Europe, or China, and not really manufacturing it themselves.
Yeah, what does that actually mean in the long run for these countries and the kind of sustainability of their programs?
To me, that's the really interesting question. You know, what's exciting about this private space mission that just came back from the International Space Station, it's just the second one. And what we're seeing is the lower cost to get to space, thanks to companies like SpaceX collaborating with NASA. We're going to see a lot more people of all different nationalities and backgrounds go to space. We're actually going to have a crowded International Space Station, which we haven't had in a long time. But my question for these countries is always, getting these people up there is great. They're getting important experience. But will this translate to a domestic industry making rockets, making satellites, developing your own indigenous space missions that don't depend on Western companies?
How much is military and national pride and just keeping up with the Joneses part of this?
Certainly national pride and keeping up with the Joneses is a huge part of every space program. But the military question is interesting. Obviously, militaries are increasingly dependent on space, particularly the U.S. Saudi Arabia in particular and the UAE are both major purchasers of U.S. military technology. You know, buying an F-16 is not quite the same, but pretty similar to buying a seat on a Dragon spacecraft. And so it's going to be interesting to see whether these countries are content to continue to rely on sort of the U.S. space umbrella, or if they're going to try and replicate it. It's interesting to see Iran has its own space program that hasn't been hugely successful, thanks to all the sanctions against it. But with China playing a role in mediating between Iran and Saudi Arabia, maybe there will be less concern for, you know, military space technology among these countries. Or maybe with access to China, they'll be able to either buy higher tech military gear from them or from the U.S.
Tim Fernholz is a senior reporter at Quartz and the author of Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. Tim, thanks a lot. Really appreciate your time today.
Pleasure to be here.
In southwestern Mexico, drug cartels have increased the use of drones in their operations. Drug barons are allegedly using the drones to drop bombs to drive villagers out of their homes. It seems the cartels want to have full control over territory for drug trafficking. Earlier this May, about 600 people had to flee from a town in the region. That's according to a Mexican human rights organization. Drone use by cartels is not new, but more of the criminal groups are turning to them as they have access to cheaper drone technology. Romain Lecour studies cartels for the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. Tell us more about how the cartels are actually using drones on these villages, Romain.
As you mentioned, drug cartels have been using drones for the past, let's say, 2-3 years. They buy very small drones to use them to do surveillance, to film their regions, to monitor the regions, to monitor who's in and who's out. Then they've been using the drones to monitor the regions, but also film like violent operations, confrontation with other groups, confrontation with the army, et cetera, et cetera. So they actually were using the drones to record videos they were using on social media, kind of propaganda for the groups as well. And then apparently they started changing the way they were functioning. They were just using normal commercial drones, but adding a small like kind of clip to it so they could use it also to drop small, very, very, very handcrafted bombs and explosive charges, which have been used mainly in the states of Michoacán and Guerrero, to my knowledge.
What's been the reaction from villagers who are in the line of fire?
I think villagers have been extremely concerned about the use of drones, especially because we're talking about very rural areas of Mexico. So you're living in small villages, you're living in the mountains, in remote areas. So actually using a drone to do anything is extremely useful, right? You can, again, like monitor people, you can check what people are doing from a very long distance, of course. And then there is one concern of the use of drones in a more like attack mode. It's been not necessarily used directly against populations in Michoacán. I think it's slowly changing and slightly changing.
What kind of situation would cartels use a drone to attack in?
In Michoacán, at least, they were using the drones to attack other cartels. So basically, if they would hear or know about a position of a enemy drug cartel group, for example, they would say, we know there is a small outpost from this drug cartel group positioned in the mountains. So they would just like use the drone, attach the small charge, explosive charge to it, and use the drone to attack the small outpost from the drug cartel.
How are authorities in Mexico on the ground dealing with this?
I think they were very concerned in Michoacán in the past years to see drug cartels using drones. The use of drones in Michoacán somehow has gone down. I don't know if it's an effect or the Mexican forces, the Mexican government, the Mexican authorities in general actually putting pressure on drug cartels to stop doing this. From what we hear right now, they are using it again. I think they're very concerned because, again, it shows how the tactical and technical advantage that the Mexican forces should have against drug cartels in very tactical operative terms is not necessarily the case all the time. Somehow it shows that the Mexican army somehow is losing a bit of terrain in a way.
And how alarming is it for authorities that cartels are fighting each other with drones?
I think it is very alarming. And again, the use of drones, as we all know, just allows you to pilot them from anywhere. So you can actually use them to cause massive casualties to other people, but also to houses, of course, because the people using the drones are not like professionally trained pilots. So they do mistakes, they commit mistakes. They use them to bomb like enemy cartel positions, but they can also bomb like a house, for example. We're talking like, again, like small scale effects and impacts. But I think it is worrisome that you have like, again, one more tool within the drug cartel's ability to use different weapons today.
Roma, help us understand why the cartels are terrorizing their own neighbors like this.
It's a way of showing that you're the boss. It's a way of showing that if you need people to leave their homes, you're able to do it and to put so much pressure on people that they will eventually leave their homes. You want to control the territory with the people, but you want them terrorized that you're able to do anything at any time. You want the territory maybe to exploit some natural resources. For example, different private companies wanted to turn to illegal logging, for example, to illegal mining operations as well. So I think it's again like one more tool in the hands of controlling more territory, controlling more resources, and having more access to what is today, to my opinion, at least in Mexico, a very mafia-like environment, if you wish.
Romain Lacour studies cartels for the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. Thank you very much for joining us today, Romain.
Thank you very much.
The war in Ukraine has energized patriotism there, so it's not surprising that many Ukrainians are embracing symbols of national identity, the language, the flag, music. Increasingly, Ukrainians are also expressing patriotism on their bodies. The World's Daniel Hoffman has our next story from the capital, Kyiv.
Mykola Dubrovin got his first tattoo 10 years ago, and he didn't start small.
The first design was the rose, and the session was, I think, 5 or 6 hours. After this session, I said, okay, please book in me on next one. The next one was 10 hours.
And Dubrovin says he was already imagining the design for yet another tattoo.
The feelings that I make something special on my body, and maybe inside of me something tell me that, okay, it's art, you like the art, you need to continue doing this.
Tattoos became his passion. In 2019, he opened his own studio here in Kyiv. The business thrived up until February 24th of last year.
This day changed everything.
It was the day Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
All of my windows was broken because one of the rockets was falling around my apartment. I woke up and said, okay, let's start it.
Dubrovin was forced to shut down his business. Everyone was scrambling to get their families to safety. 3 months later, when life in Kyiv felt safer, he reopened the tattoo studio.
The first 3 or 4 months, 80% of people want to make their patriotic tattoos. People want to make Ukrainian symbols to improve their feelings and show their Ukrainian culture.
People got Ukrainian flags, the Ukrainian trident, the map of the country, and other national symbols. The trend continues to this day. Андрій Лукачук is one of the tattoo artists here.
Я був військовим, тобто військові звертались також.
In the beginning of the full-scale invasion, a lot of military people would come and I would do a lot of tattoo for the soldiers.
Б'ють також герби або емблеми їх батальйонів.
A lot of soldiers would get tridents, they would get the symbols of their units, their battalions. Some soldiers would get like the pictures of their relatives or family members.
As we speak, Lukáček is working on Andriy Vasanovich's right arm, which is almost completely covered in ink.
Це патріотичний козак, статуя незалежності, ну і родина мать. Ну і дівчина.
Vasanovich points to the image of a Cossack, a Ukrainian warrior, the famous motherland monument in Kyiv, and then a quote from the Ukrainian national poet Taras Shevchenko. He says he wanted to get Ukrainian-themed tattoos before the invasion, but the war gave him that final nudge. Daria Kurudymova is 27 years old, and she says she's wanted to get a tattoo since she was 16.
Я так достаточно нерішительний чоловік, і мені тяжело було на щось себе пододвинути.
I'm a pretty indecisive person, but with war, there's a feeling that you might not get a chance to do the things you've dreamed about for a long time.
Kurudymova says the war helped her overcome many of her fears. And one thing she was afraid of at first was facing the tattoo needle. She says she was so nervous she was shaking.
My tattoo artist was kind of like my psychologist.
Kurudymova says on a couple of occasions during her sessions at the tattoo studio, air raid sirens went off, and they even heard explosions outside. But she says they would just keep going, no matter what. The whole tattoo experience, she says, has had a calming effect on her. Here's Mykola Dubrovin again, the tattoo studio owner.
We are making the big projects. For these projects, we need to spend at least 7 days. So while in this, we are knowing each other very good. We're starting with the clients and finishing with the friends.
Dubrovin says that tattoos are not just art. In many cases, he says tattoos can give people confidence, even courage. And that's something that he hopes can be another permanent outcome of his work. For the world, Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
You are standing near a scenic spot, say a lake or a reservoir. You're taking a selfie and your phone slips from your hand into the water. Whoops. Oh, you also happen to be a local government official. Double whoops. So your next step, naturally, is to order that reservoir drained so you can get your phone back. triple whoops. This was a case last week in the central Indian state of Chhattisgarh. Food inspector Rajesh Vishwas dropped his Samsung smartphone in the water at Kerkata Dam. The Times of India newspaper reports that divers tried to recover it, and when they couldn't, diesel pumps were brought in to drain 2 million liters of water from the reservoir. Vishwas says he got permission to drain the dam, claiming his phone contained sensitive government data. The phone was ultimately recovered after 3 days and, no surprise, was too waterlogged to start up. Vishwas is out one phone. He's out of his job. Authorities suspended him for wasting water resources, enough to irrigate more than 1,500 acres. India, remember, is one of the planet's most water-stressed countries. Even if you're not a gamer, you know that sound. Video games have come a long, long way since Pac-Man was munching on his pellets. We'd drop a quarter in an arcade machine that could weigh 200 pounds or a lot more. I know I did. Those were the days when I actually played video games, Pac-Man especially. As you know, these days, games are much more portable and sophisticated. A little Call of Duty for some of you fans. The lifelike graphics are crazy good, and soon people could have all of that right on their phones, thanks to innovations in cloud gaming. British regulators, though, are throwing a wrench into the revolution. To sort this out, we turn to Joost van Drunen. He's an adjunct assistant professor at New York University's Stern School of Business. Joost, before we get to the current fight over who's going to control cloud gaming, help us understand what it is. In a nutshell, how does cloud gaming work?
Cloud gaming is a new technology that really builds on the ability to do the computational effort outside of the user's devices, right? So it's in the cloud. That's where all the computation takes place. That's where all the graphics are calculated, and it sends a signal to your local device. That's in a nutshell how cloud gaming works.
And so is this seen as a future of gaming, or are we looking at a future where there will be no more consoles at home?
The short answer is no. Don't want to ruin the surprise there, but historically, new technologies like this, they don't make existing ones redundant, rather they build on them. They grow the pie overall. And when it comes to cloud gaming in general, it's an important part of the future of gaming in that we now can reach people that we couldn't reach before, right? The console industry is limited because it's a physical device. Import taxes make it very, very expensive, particularly for the southern hemisphere of the globe. And so you have all these people that want to play ostensibly but can't actually get the devices. So as long as devices are out of reach of most consumers, the market can't really grow into, say, emerging economies and otherwise. So it would allow more people access to interactive entertainment.
Gotcha. So let's take a look at what's playing out in the UK. UK Microsoft is trying to buy Activision Blizzard. That is a publisher of the multi-billion dollar Call of Duty franchise. Price tag, $70 billion. Now, the UK's watchdog says that would thwart innovation and essentially create a monopoly. What would be the impact on cloud gaming if the sale were to proceed?
What we would see is a large tech company investing in infrastructure and content to go with it, right? And so I'm of the opinion that it would break open the cloud gaming market even more than it already has. Whereas the CMA, the UK regulators, doesn't agree with me on this. They think of it as something that would give Microsoft a disproportional advantage over its competitors, allowing it to basically corner the market in cloud gaming for itself. And it does so by arguing that publishers like Activision Blizzard would have their own services available, that they would develop their own cloud gaming services and subscriptions that you see, for instance, with Microsoft Xbox Game Pass and with Sony PlayStation Plus. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think in many ways, blocking the deal will be anti-competitive. It disincentivizes large tech platforms from investing in the infrastructure necessary to facilitate cloud gaming.
You're saying you believe if the sale were to proceed, it would actually foster innovation?
Yes. So the easy way to say it is that the mobile game space is basically an oligopoly. There's two major providers of content there. As a publisher like Activision, it's very difficult to negotiate against them because you need them to give access to audience. And so a publisher, even the size of an Activision with $11 billion a year, is sort of incapable of really negotiating on fair terms. However, if Microsoft would be sitting on that end of the table, suddenly Apple and Google will have a much more formidable, much larger firm to contend with, which would benefit competition and ultimately consumers.
So how is Microsoft defending this deal? Do they have an argument that can get the deal past regulators in the UK?
Microsoft's argument is effectively a charm offensive, saying, look, we've made 10-year commitments to every single one of the major providers out there that we would keep parity of the Call of Duty franchise, which is to say
All the other companies that are currently offering any kind of cloud gaming service, they too will allow and facilitate Call of Duty in the same way that Microsoft will put it on its own platforms. The CMA, unfortunately, has said, yeah, that's great, but it's not good enough, even though everybody else seems to agree with this. And that's kind of the weird argument here, right? So that the concessions have convinced the EU watchdog, but not the UK watchdog.
Yeah, right. And that's an important point, because this is not just decided by the UK, right? US regulators and the EU are also weighing in.
Correct. There's roughly 17 economies that really matter in this conversation. Some countries have already greenlit the deal, but their overall clout and weight doesn't really impact it materially. It's really countries like the UK, the European Union, and of course the United States that will ultimately determine whether or not this will go through.
So Microsoft is appealing this decision in the UK. What is at stake for the future of gaming, Joost, if the appeal fails?
Will it jeopardize the future of gaming? I don't think so. The games industry has continuous momentum of innovation and technological progression. What it will do is probably make things like gaming and contemporary gaming in the UK more expensive. The larger or perhaps deeper conversation around this is that it's very awkward that on the one hand, the UK dismisses the deal and the EU approves it. So it raises the question, well, who's right? And perhaps this is a politically motivated decision, right? Is it perhaps possible that a self-isolating island off the coast of Europe is now suddenly against everything and trying to assert itself, when in fact everybody else sees it differently? So the outcome of the FTC lawsuit here in the US, which is scheduled for this summer, will probably be another moment of conversation around this.
We've been speaking with Joost van Drunen about the future of cloud gaming as Microsoft UK tries to climb to the top of the heap. Joost is an adjunct assistant professor at New York University Stern School of Business. Joost, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The second round of the French Open is underway at Roland Garros in Paris. Getting almost as much attention as the volleys on the court are the volleys off the court, the political volleys. On Sunday, Ukrainian tennis player Marta Kostyuk lost to Aryna Sabalenka of Belarus.
Set the match, Sabalenka.
After the match, Kostyuk, the Ukrainian, refused to shake Sabalenka's hand. There were boos from the crowd. Kostyuk said back in January she would not shake hands with Russian or Belarusian players while war raged in her country. Belarus is being used as a staging ground for Russia's war in Ukraine. At the post-game press conference, Kostyuk said the crowd should be embarrassed by its reaction.
I don't know. I want to see people react to it in 10 years when the war is over. I think they will not feel really nice about what they did.
And then there's Serbian player Novak Djokovic. After his win in the first round on Monday, he took a marker and scrawled a message on the lens of the TV camera.
Someone finds what's writing on the lens funny, but I'm going to turn to you. I don't even want to give it a guess.
He wrote, "Kosovo is the heart of Serbia. Stop the violence." Kosovo declared its independence from Serbia in 2008, but Serbia has refused to recognize Kosovo's statehood, and over the past few days, tensions have flared.
In northern Kosovo, ethnic Serbians clashed with NATO peacekeepers and local police.
Djokovic has been accused of fanning the flames, though he told the Serbian press that he would do it again, regardless of the consequences of his actions at the French Open. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.